What Byzantinism is this in Istanbul? Byzantium in popular culture.
Welcome everyone, this is Emir Alışık, the curator of the What Byzantinism is this in Istanbul exhibition at Pera Museum Istanbul. We are here today for an episode of the What Byzantinism is this in Istanbul podcast organized by Istanbul Research Institute. In each episode, we invite historians and artists to discuss the Byzantium-related inspirations of a particular artistic production. This show is made by the enthusiasm of the many contributors of the eponymous exhibition that is taking place between 23rd of November and 6th of March in the Pera Museum, Istanbul. Today we are together with guests whose books immensely influenced our exhibition. Ingela Nilsson is the co-editor of the book Wanted Byzantium, which is among the scarce literature that features analysis of Byzantinism in the contemporary world. And Anna Linden's novel, A Memoir Called Empire, is a unique Byzantinism, as I am sure you'll see today after this discussion, at least if you didn't read the book. Let me now briefly introduce you our guests. Let me start with Ingela Nilsson, who is actually a familiar figure for the historians of the Byzantine Empire in Istanbul, as she is the director of the Swedish Institute in Istanbul. She is also a professor in Greek and Byzantine studies at the Uppsala University. Her research interest lies in the narrative traditions between the ancient and Byzantine worlds, historiography and fictional writings in Byzantium, as well as the reception of Byzantium in the post-Byzantine Europe. Her book that she co-edited with Paul Stevenson, I just briefly mentioned that before, Wanted Byzantium, Desire for a Lost Empire, inspired and helped us immensely in the making of this exhibition. And Arkady Martin is the pen name of Dr. Anna Linden Weller that she adopts in her speculative fiction writing. As Anna Linden, she is a historian of the Byzantine Empire and a city planner. She actually did her postdoctoral research at the Uppsala University and worked with Ingela Nilsson, so it's kind of a reunion here. Anna Linden published short fiction in many prominent speculative fiction magazines, and she won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 2020 with her debut novel, A Memory Called Empire. Her second novel, a sequel to her first, A Dissolution Called Peace, is published in this year, actually. Today she is here to explain how she brought some of the elements attributed to Byzantium into sphere of a futuristic science fiction novel and how and why it worked. So thank you for joining us, both of you. We are all ears.
It's great to be here. I'm delighted to be invited. And you're right, it is a reunion. I haven't gotten to see Ingela in a long time, and it's lovely and wonderful to get to have this conversation.
It really is. It is a reunion. We've been bad at staying in touch.
We have.
I moved to Istanbul not very long after you left Uppsala, and you embarked on this fantastic new career as a novelist.
I did. I moved back to the US from Sweden, and I started writing books and have ended up working for the government of one of the US states, the state of New Mexico, in, I guess, a sort of science fictional field where I do policy work on energy and climate, and actually end up doing a lot more history work than I expected I was going to in this job, which makes me happy.
So it all comes together in a way. Also, the city planner thing.
Yeah.
That's nice. So I thought that, I mean, we are here to talk about your two novels from the perspective of Byzantinism and reception of Byzantium. But I'd like for us to do it in a slightly different way, because something that you and I share is an interest in story worlds and,
yes,
and narrative construction of worlds. And it's something we talked a lot about in Uppsala, because when you were doing your postdoc, we were reading our way through a lot of
narratology.
Post-classical narratology. We read David Herman's book on story worlds, which was sort of quite new. Right then. So I was wondering if you could start by saying, explain to someone who's not into narratology, what is a story world?
Ah, yes. So this is perhaps my favorite thing about narratology, like, well, post-classical narratology that I got to learn while I was in Uppsala, is this concept of a story world. So it's the world that is made inside a narrative. It is the world that is described by both the spoken, stated rules of that world, like to use a science fiction example, if there is a world where there is faster than light travel in a book, then part of the rules of that story world is that faster than light travel exists. And we know that out here in the world we spend most of our time in, as far as we are aware, fast and light travel does not exist. So the two worlds are different in this way. But the world of the story world is not just the rules that are stated so plainly. It's also the implications and the concept of the entire space that the fictional narrative dwells within. And it doesn't, and one of the things I love about it is it doesn't just apply to what we would traditionally think of as fiction, something composed as a not true, not mimetic reflection of the world. It also applies to any sort of narrative construction, an ideology, a sense of nationalism. This describes a way that the world works inside the narrative, the rules that have to be true for that narrative to be true. And these can be contradictory between different people's narratives, and therefore they can understand what an event means, or even what happened in an event, in very different ways. And the story world concept really helps to define why, or describe why.
And the worlds have their own logic, so they suit certain genres particularly well, like fantasy and superhero comics and sci-fi, I gather. And so you created a story world for your novels. I have them here. They were kind enough to lend these books from the Istanbul Institute to me, and you created. The world of the interstellar takes Kalanli Empire.
Well done. Most people don't get it the first time.
I've been practicing. I'll get back to the language part a bit later, but I thought that perhaps not everyone has read your novels yet. So could you sort of briefly describe the world that you created and the very briefly sort of the main plot, like the sure. primary protagonist?
So I've created in these novels a very far future universe. So it is the story of a vast multi-planetary system space empire called Texcalan, and its interactions with other sort of polities outside of it, one of which is the home of the protagonist of the first novel. The home is called Lassell Station, which is basically a floating mining station. It's not a planet. It's completely constructed of metal and other human-made materials. So kind of a parked generation ship. And the main storyline is that a young woman from Lassell Station is summoned to the heart of the Empire, the central planet, to be the ambassador from her people to the center of the empire. And she has to do this because the person who used to be that ambassador has mysteriously disappeared. So it starts out as a kind of murder mystery spy novel, and it turns into something that's more along the lines of interstellar politics and court culture. It's a very Byzantine novel, and that's quite deliberate because I wrote most of it while I was in Sweden doing a postdoc at the same time. I often describe it as kind of the fictional version of the academic work I was working on at the time. And my academic work was very concerned with how cultural narratives of empire and borderlands are constructed by those people who experience them, and how they interface with each other, especially in areas of colonization and of trauma, actually, on the edges of an empire. And I kind of reversed it for the story because I sent my protagonist, Mahit, to the center But she brings a lot of borderland concerns with her. So the world of Texcalan is highly influenced culturally by the Middle Byzantine period. And that's in terms of thinking about how people define what is inside the empire, what is out. So this, a concept of someone who is Texcalanly, i.e. is Roman, inside, and everybody else who isn't that is a barbarian of some kind. And they're still people, they're just a different kind of people, maybe not quite as good. And the ideas about how someone might try to move from one state to another and not be able to, or make that attempt and realize it's something that is damaging to them personally. I'm fascinated, and both in an academic sense and in a story sense, about the choices people make under that kind of cultural pressure. And this is something that I had been working on in my postdoc, which is I read a great deal of letters from people, Byzantine people mostly, working on the edges of the empire, and tried to interpret what those letters were doing to maintain their sense of things being okay, narratively. Because one of the, to go back to story worlds for a moment, one of the interesting tricks that a story world can do is to explain why things happen to a person, explain the almost cosmological reasons for both bad and good things. And these and explanations, humans find explanations very comforting. So it interests me both in a character sense and in an academic sense, what happens to people who have to use a narrative deliberately to make themselves feel like what is happening to them makes sense. And I ended up exploring that a great deal in the novels as well. So I don't know if that's really a plot summary.
It was a good plot summary because it took us into this sort of the boundary between academic writing and fictional writing. And I think we'll try to get there a bit later. But it's very true that reading the novels is like another version of reading your academic writing. I think that's an interesting, and especially to me who worked quite closely with you when you wrote those mm-hmm. articles while in Uppsala, it really does, the novels do bring up many concerns that were at the heart of your research. I think that's really interesting. You said yourself this is a very Byzantine novel or a Byzantine story world, and obviously people familiar with Byzantium will already have recognized certain features, the empire as the center of the world, but there are also features of the novel, of the plot, like poetry mm-hmm. As diplomacy, poetry as political propaganda. There's frequent use of political verse and other yes. cadences and meters that are familiar to Byzantinists. There's even a citation from a Catena commentary in book okay. two. So there's a lot of Byzantium for those who are interested in reception to look at, but there are also other elements. I'm sure there are many, but what I've been thinking a lot about is the Aztec element and the modern American empire.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Texcalan is not Byzantium for many reasons. One being, I think the biggest one being that I didn't want to write a story that was about Christianity. And to me, as a Byzantinist, you can't really get Christianity out of Byzantium. Mm-hmm. Like they're so intrinsically linked, in especially when we are considering imperial ideology, that just there's a great deal of infiltration of one to the other. And I am not myself a Christian, and therefore when I write fiction, I don't necessarily want to engage with that particular exploration of worldview. It wouldn't have been where I wanted to go with the story. So one of the first things I did was try to figure out if I was going to pull away from a monotheistic religion in my world building, in creating the story world of Texcalan, what would I use instead? What influences could I draw on? And I began to think about a just a personal interest of mine, which is in the Mesoamerican empires of the same era, actually, and a little later, as the Byzantine, the parts of Byzantium that I'm particularly interested in. And I started thinking about how, what might a 7,000 years in the future Aztec influenced religious and theological structure look like, that has moved quite far away from its, if the Texcalani even are actual descendants of Mesoamerican people, which I've decided I don't know, so it doesn't really matter. But thinking about a sacrifice religion, thinking about a religion that has become diffuse in whether it's got gods or not, but definitely has a relationship to the elements of the world, the sky, the stars, that in some ways could have been a sun worship religion. And that, of course, brought me back to monotheism and Mithraic religions, all of which had sort of gotten into the mix. This is the problem with having a historian write fiction, is that I have too much fun just putting together all the bits I've ever liked. But what really interested me about working with a Mesoamerican influence was that it freed me from some of the boundaries that I think I would have felt if I had been trying to recreate my academic work. Texcalani is not a good, quote unquote, representation of Byzantium. It's not a copy. It's quite a different thing. And being able to throw in cultural influences on a serious level from places that weren't the place I had spent a decade of my life immersed in, let me take more creative liberties without feeling like I was betraying either my story or what I know about medieval Byzantium. And then there's the modern American thing. So for my various sins, I am an American. And I think a great deal about cultural imperialism, having lived in a lot of places that aren't America, and discovering how deep American culture has spread without, I guess, like without the knowledge of ye everyday American, like, not that I am that, but I don't think about it. And then I show up in Armenia and there are McDonald's, and that's a very simple thing, but it's also very huge when you think about it. That kind of soft power, the cultural power of omnipresence, is something which I think is actually a Byzantine thing as well, but one which is harder to see for a lot of reasons having to do with the way mass media works now, and how we don't have a great deal of ephemera from the Byzantine period, like ephemeral stories, propaganda, etc. That doesn't get preserved. So, but I think it is actually a characteristic of centralizing empires to not just reach out militarily or in terms of trade and taxation, but to simply make the entire world themselves.
Yeah.
So, and that was an important thing for me to explore when I was doing this story.
I think what's really nice about the kind of hybrid story world that you created, drawing on different empires from different times, is that the story becomes Byzantine in itself, because it's very palimpsestic. There are so many layers, and there are so many, it's like successful Byzantine recycling, where you put lots of things together into something new. And that really, I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
But that also makes me think of something that concerned me a lot in the last couple of years, is the significance of that recycling and putting together, and to what extent allusions have agency, actually point at something, or if they are just there as bits and pieces for the construction. And I've been curious to know, whether do you want your readers to see the different elements, or do you prefer, is it like a game between you and them, or do you prefer that they just look at the whole and avoid saying, oh, there's something Byzantine here? Because in the end, it's sort of you know, it's all in the reader's hands. We can do whatever we want with your book. But how do you feel about that?
I think I want both, and it depends on the reader. It's important to me that someone who does not know anything about any of what we've been talking about, no story world, no Byzantium, no Mesoamerican, Nahuatl speaking peoples, be able to pick up the book and enjoy it as a story, like sui generis, just something they're experiencing. And I think if I was not doing that, then it wouldn't be a very commercial novel. And to my delighted surprise, it apparently is a commercial Indeed. Novel. I did not think it would be, but all right, it's wonderful. But when I am a reader, I have always loved feeling like I am in on a secret, or that I spotted the illusion, or I found the commonality. This is one of the reasons I ended up studying Byzantium, because I found a certain self-identification with that process that is so central to a lot of what I would call Byzantine memory culture. So I am also writing for the reader who spots it, who I would like to evoke that kind of delight, or that the opposite, the good opposite of delight, which is sort of the friction of knowing something and therefore being able to be worried about it. Mm-hmm. I know what this will mean because I have the key or the secret, or I think this means that. So it's both at once. As a writer, in some senses, I am always, when I write the first draft, I write for me, as if I was the reader, as if I would want to read this story. And then on later drafts, I have my partner read, and my partner is very good at telling me when I have not explained anything, and I just think I have. So that's the first opening up. And then usually my editors tend to say, you have forgotten to put in half the story. We can see where it should be. You should put the rest of it in. And that's another layer of inviting people to come with me. I do want to be accessible, is the wrong word, because I don't mind being complicated at all, but open, maybe.
Mm. So I'd like to share with you one of my sort of Byzantinist readings of a certain feature, and we'll see what you say about that. I think a lot of readers have been really fascinated by the imago or imago machine. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Depends on your native language, so either's fine.
Could you explain for the people who haven't read, what is this machine or a device?
Yeah, so it's a very science fictional device, which is basically a way of memory sharing. In the culture that my protagonist, Mahit, comes from, they don't have very many people and they have a very difficult life, so people die often. And they have a technology that allows them to place the memories of the person who used to have the job that someone is doing inside their mind. And that those memories come with some bits of personality attached. And that I decided was something I wanted to include based on some research I did on neurology. And the research I had done on neurology also told me that imago machines are completely impossible. So they're not something that can ever really exist. But memory and personality moving down a chain, along sometimes a multi-generational chain.
Yeah.
And there's also a physical aspect to it, which becomes a plot point in the book. Because
right.
Mahit's goes wrong and then she has to have back alley neurosurgery to fix it.
It's quite complicated. But I was thinking that, as you say, it's a very sci-fi thing on the one hand, but at the same time, I think that to me then, as a Byzantinist reading this, it reminds me of, you know, long tradition of transmissions of manuscripts and copying old texts and chronicles put together of bits and pieces from the previous generation. And even oral storytelling for part of the tradition where we don't have texts and so on. And also sort of the title of your first novel, A Memory Called Empire, which I don't actually know whether that is an allusion to something like the title of the second novel, but to me it becomes like the empire that is only a memory, because it's only the transmission of knowledge and, mm-hmm. and sort of nothing else. Would that be an interpretation that made sense to you?
Yes. So the Inigo machines, I was thinking a lot about institutional knowledge, like, and how easy that is to lose.
Mm-hmm. An archive that burns, yeah. or a library that yes. disappears.
Yes. And I was thinking very much about what would it be like to not lose it the way you'd expect to, like, because a person is fallible. So are places and objects that have recordings, but to have something that the people who are doing it believe is a fix for all of that, but isn't, like, that there are reuse in Palimpsest work does not reproduce exactly the original text. It is in a different context. And that difference, that shape of what changes when you change the context of how you are reading or how you come to experience a particular piece of knowledge, which could be instructions or poetry or a story about the founding of a city, it really does become a different thing for a different person. And that's one of the explorations that the Imago machines let me do, because there is knowledge that passes down fairly accurately, but it's all through interpretation of a person. And in terms of the titles, I mean, yes, it is backformed from the title of the second book, which I actually found first.
Oh, and right. The Tacitus.
And I was reading Tacitus and just was like, oh, that's so good. I still love that line. And it would be a great title for the second book. And I had been trying to title the first book with my editor for quite some time. It felt like throwing water balloons at a wall. Like, suggest a title and she'd be like, nah, not that one. And we would just keep going like that. So I had this sort of moment of, oh, the title for the second book should be this, and asked her if that was a good one. She said, yeah, that's great. Can you make the first one sound like that? Mm. And then it was instant, like right away, because I knew the thematic relevance of the first one. I knew what I wanted it to evoke, which is that sense of what is empire except for how people recreate it and reproduce it, even when it's alive. Like, the action of colonization is a reproduction of empire. So what is it but memory, and how memory is made? And then when I had the sort of format of the title, it was incredibly easy to find. I think it took me about 10 minutes.
Mm. That's really interesting. It's so fascinating to hear about the process behind a title you've been wondering a bit about. I wanted to bring up language because, I knew when we worked together that you were really interested in language.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I realized quite how interested in languages you were until I read the first novel. The novels deal with language in a fairly technical sense.
Yes.
But also in a poetic and sort of allegorical sense in the way you just described for the titles. How did this, you created the language?
I did.
A partial language.
It is a very
How did this come
language.
About?
Originally, it was far more Greek than it is, but then I thought it would be too obvious. So I scrapped all of it and started over. So the language in the novels, Texcalani, is based on Nahuatl, which is the language of the Aztec Empire and many other peoples in Mesoamerica. But it is not Nahuatl. It follows different rules. It has very Nahuatl sound patterns. And this is, I think, what Ingela means about technical. I I have done some historical linguistics before I met you, a while before. I had done a little bit of that at Oxford. And when I was learning Armenian at Oxford, it was taught in a very technical way, which I find good for my brain, at least, to understand not only the grammatical constructions of a language, but why those grammatical constructions have developed over time. But my attempts to work with languages that I know at least some, so Greek or Armenian, the Lasalle Station's language is very, very close to Armenian, I think, it felt too much like I was doing a poor imitation, which I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to move farther away from what I knew and also be respectful to a language family that I hadn't spent as much time with, because I don't speak Nahuatl at all. So therefore I didn't try to reproduce their rules for how plurals are formed. The plurals in Texcalanli are from Hebrew, because that was easiest and I just grabbed it, and it's a really easy one to do. And also it sounds good with all of these particular consonants. But I guess I do think of language in this very, it's both technical and for me musical, which are quite close together. And that's because when I'm creating a language, I'm thinking a lot about sound, and the sound that I want the word that I'm creating to make so that it evokes a feeling of one kind or another, or has a rhythm in a line on a page. I mean, I remember trying to come up with I think it's in one of the epigrams in the second book where I needed the name of a stringed instrument, and trying to find a name that for a stringed instrument that fit in the sentence that also had the connotations I wanted. And I ended up with several Nahuatl dictionaries and a whole lot of willingness to rearrange parts of words into other parts of words. But I think also I decided fairly early on that I didn't want to not have the technical part of understanding a language, especially an imperial language, not be part of the story. I knew it would be a challenge for some readers to be able to think about, all right, so what are they doing? They're using a particular mode of formality in a language, or they're using a word which can mean these three things, and the protagonist doesn't know which one, because she's not a native speaker, she doesn't have connotation. And I decided that that was a challenge I was good with, that it was something that I was willing to ask of my reader, because then what it allowed me to do was really, in some ways, evoke my own experience of trying to learn languages in other countries and feeling like grammar and structure was the backbone and the only thing I really had, and there like something to hold on to, something to sort of use to analyze what's going on around me. And also it let me tell the reader a great deal about the culture of the world, because language does that. And we often don't think about how language does that when it is a language we know very well or is our native language. But for someone who is coming into a culture who knows the language but is not fluent in it, is not comfortable, when you notice that the word for empire and world are the same word, that means something that someone born in that culture probably doesn't think about, because that's just the word for those things. Mm. And that lets me tell the reader what's important as well. And I think I would have written that very differently had I not been trained in the languages I was trained in.
Mm. I think you do it really well. It's almost as if you created a soundscape in a way to go with the story world. And especially in the second novel, sounds are very important and very much part of the storyline. But I wanted to bring up also, because part of the language and part of the soundscapes are the names of the people. because what you did is to create a world in which names are not gendered, but also a world in which gender does not matter to the same extent as it does in our society for sexual relationships or positions in society. It's not really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you do that so exceptionally well. I thought it would be much more difficult to do that, but you just did it. And I think a lot of people who read your novels really
appreciate that. It was important to me, actually. And also to have gender still be something that mattered, but not in the way it matters in our society. Like I wanted it to be like something that people just do. Some people care a great deal about what their hair looks like. Most people care some about what their hair looks like. Some people really don't at all. So sort of thinking of gender as something like that, most people have got one. Some people care a lot about it, and some people can't be bothered, and some people have got an interesting or unusual one. And to just sort of take, I wanted the problems that the characters had in the novel to be about cultural imperialism and about politics and about like figuring out whether cross-cultural relationships can be safe or good, as opposed to the gender of the people doing any of those things. Like, that wasn't the problem I was interested in. So I decided to pretend very hard it didn't exist. And it seems to have worked out. I also really did want to have gender have nothing to do with what people did in the world, as I mean, I find it utopian, but I also find it an ideal that I'd like to work toward in the world we have, where it shouldn't matter what gender you are, with what you do and what opportunities are open to you. So I guess that's aspirational in that bit.
I think that could also bring us sort of back to reception of Byzantium in a broader sense, because that's where I would like us to sort of end.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the way in which Byzantium is used right now in the world is not very positive, at least not from our perspective. It has a lot to do with populism and nationalism and masculinity and claiming something that is yours by heritage, mm-hmm. and so on. Your way of using the Byzantine is very different from that. You create something that a lot of those people would really dislike.
Yes, I think they would.
you address issues of cultural appropriation and gender roles and cultural imperialism. But what do you think what does it mean also in the wider sense now of this exhibition, looking at pop reception of Byzantium? What does it mean to use and display and represent what Byzantium was today? What can we do with that?
It's interesting because when I was writing it, I wasn't really thinking of it as being a countercultural reception. And that might have been because of when I was writing it, which was about 5 or 6 years ago now. And it's also because I wasn't writing it because I wanted to intervene in the conversation. I was writing it because I love Byzantium. And my experience of Byzantium is both the fascination of the outsider with the empire and a certain amount of, I guess, self-repulsion for why do I like this thing so much? Isn't it not exactly a great thing? and I think that's where I come from, that it is beautiful, that the things about it that I've tried to show people in a very different context are what I find interesting and seductive and gorgeous about it. But also those very same things are things I find destructive and dangerous about it, and the two can exist right next to each other. So I think I wrote it for me in a lot of ways, and it's ended up, it would be very interesting to sort of do a side-by-side reading with some of the very nationalist, very masculine interpretations of Byzantium, uses of Byzantium. But I'm not sure I'm using Byzantium per se in these books. I don't think I am using it for a purpose aside from the way my experience of working with and thinking about Byzantium has shaped the way I think about narrative and culture and what I'm interested in. It is not purpose built, it's very organic.
And perhaps that's why it worked out so well, because it was allowed to grow. I will end by a question that a lot of people ask me. Have you left Byzantine studies altogether, or will you ever go back to?
I would like to someday. I really would. I miss it, doing it all the time. I mean, I read everything, and I don't know if I will ever return to academia in that sense. I'm surprisingly happy in the civil service. But I'd love to keep doing research and keep writing. I just need to figure out how to add that to the novels and the civil service. But I'm not done. I don't think I'm ever going to be done with it in a real way. I do hope to someday write more and do more research and publish more.
And are you going to stay in the same story world? Do you have writing projects or...?
Yes and no is the answer to that one. My next book is in a different story world, but the one after that will be back in Tixkalan, I think. So I'm trying to decide which Tixkalan story I want to tell. The next book is a story about drought and fire in the American West in the future. So it's kind of more of a cyberpunk novel. I wanted to try and see if I could do that, if it's something that it's another skill set, really, than writing this sort of epic. But much the way that I expect to never be done with Byzantium, I don't think I'm ever going to be done with Tixkalan. There are 100 stories that I could tell in that universe. I do feel that the two books that are published are a unit, are a set, and there isn't a three. There's other stories that interlace with that one.
Well, I look forward to any kind of academic writing or fictional writing that you will do in the future. And I'm so happy that this came out of your stay in Uppsala in addition to the scholarship that you produced. And it's wonderful. I really want to congratulate you on your success. It's fantastic.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So very happy
much.
For you. And thank you for this. And thank you also to the Istanbul Research Institute for bringing us together for such a good opportunity.
I mean, thank you both. And I'm glad that we are ending this with good tidings of new upcoming fiction and promise of academic research from Anna Linden. And I really wanted to say that we are hoping to see your fiction in Turkish too.
I believe there is a contract with a publisher, but it is being translated right now. I don't know, have a publication date, but I know we did have a contract with a Turkish publisher, which I'm very excited about.
Even better news. So glad to hear that. And thank you, Anna Linden, and thank you, Ingela, for joining us today. It was so nice, so amazing. Hope to see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
What Byzantinism is this in Istanbul? Byzantium in popular culture.